join with England to oppose Spanish efforts to retain Madrid's South American colonies, which were in revolt. The real issue, Jefferson replied, was more general than particular. How should the United States think of European adventurism in its hemisphere? The question presented by the letters you have sent me is the most momentous which has ever been offered to my contemplation since that of independence, Jefferson wrote Monroe. Our first and fundamental maxim should be never to entangle ourselves in the broils of Europe. Our second, never to suffer Europe to intermeddle with cross-Atlantic affairs. America, North and South, has a set of interests distinct from those of Europe, and peculiarly her own. The doctrine that bears Monroe's name, that the United States opposes all European intervention in the Western Hemisphere, owes much to the work of Monroe's Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, who was instrumental in the formulation of the policy. But it was also at least partly of Jeffersonian inspiration. In Jefferson's case, it was fitting that a man who had spent his life in pursuit of control would extend it as far as he could in the service of his nation, leaving a kind of last declaration of independence. This time it was a matter of policy, not of revolution. It was a declaration, all the same. In the 1824 presidential election, Jefferson saw anew that the founders' dream of the end of party was still a dream, something that might come true in the future, but surely not in the present. Writing Lafayette, Jefferson said, "You are not to believe that these two parties are amalgamated, that the lion and the lamb are lying down together. The Hartford Convention, the victory of Orleans, the peace of Ghent, prostrated the name of federalism. Its votaries abandoned it through shame and mortification, and now call themselves Republicans. But the name alone is changed. The principles are the same." The presidential field was unusually large in 1824. There was John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts, Henry Clay of Kentucky, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, William Crawford of Georgia, and Andrew Jackson of Tennessee. The race, in part, represented a generational shift. Jackson had been born the year Jefferson began his law practice, and had been a 14-year-old prisoner of war in 1781, the year Jefferson escaped from Tarleton at Monticello. Jefferson favored Crawford, a veteran of Madison's and Monroe's cabinets. The Georgian suffered a stroke in late 1823, however, and the election was ultimately decided in the House of Representatives in February 1825. Though Jackson won the most popular votes, Adams was chosen in the House after Clay, who was to become Adams' Secretary of State, gave his support to Adams. Jackson's charges of a corrupt bargain would fuel his own ambitions to avenge his defeat in 1828, which he did. Arriving at Monticello in a procession of trumpets and banners, Lafayette stepped out of his carriage on a brilliant autumn day in November 1824 at the east front of the house. Lafayette, now 67 years old, had come to America for a triumphant farewell tour, a living monument, like Adams and Jefferson, to days that seemed ever more glorious and distant. Finally stooped with age in his 81st year, Jefferson walked toward his guest. They embraced without embarrassment, two old revolutionaries who had seen the best and the worst of their times and of their countries. "My dear Jefferson," said the guest. "My dear Lafayette," replied the host. They had not laid eyes on each other for more than 30 years, and Jefferson was graciously determined to honor Lafayette not only for the Frenchman's services to the revolutionary cause, but to the cause of the young nation during Jefferson's years in France. At a banquet in Lafayette's honor in Charlottesville, Jefferson drafted a toast to be read. "His deeds in the War of Independence you have heard and read. They are known to you and embalmed in your memories and in the pages of faithful history. His deeds in the peace which followed that war are perhaps not known to you, but I can attest them. When I was stationed in his country, he made our cause his own. His influence and connections there were great. All doors of all departments were open to him at all times, to me only formally and at appointed times. In truth, I only held the nail. He drove it. Honor him, then, as your benefactor in peace as well as in war. There was a benedictory quality to Jefferson's toast, a broader message to his countrymen there and far beyond, for he knew his words would be published and read everywhere. Born and bred among your fathers, led by their partiality into the line of public life, I labored in fellowship with them through that arduous struggle, which, freeing us from foreign bondage, established us in the rights of self-government, rights which have blessed ourselves and will bless, in their sequence, all the nations of the earth. In a particular place, a universal theme. In old age, Jefferson was the Jefferson of youth, a man who honored the work of politics, the comradeship of service, and the ideas that drove flawed men to fight for causes larger than themselves. As Jefferson aged, he retained his conversational skill of speaking of topics of special interest to his companion of the moment. When those were exhausted, he would muse widely about the past and the future. He was always gracious. In conversation, Mr. Jefferson is easy and natural, and apparently not ambitious. It is not loud, as challenging general attention, but usually addressed to the person next to him. Daniel Webster wrote of an 1824 stay at Monticello. Jefferson spoke of science and letters, and especially the University of Virginia, which is coming into existence almost entirely from his exertions. When we were with him, his favorite subjects were Greek and Anglo-Saxon, historical recollections of the times and events of the Revolution, and of his residence in France from 1783 and 4 to 1789. A New Englander, Webster was unhappy about the rise of Andrew Jackson in the West. Jefferson apparently shared at least some of Webster's fears. "I feel much alarmed at the prospect of seeing General Jackson president," Jefferson said, according to Webster. "He is one of the most unfit men I know of for such a place. He has had very little respect for laws or constitutions, and is, in fact, an able military chief. His passions are terrible." On reading Webster's account, the biographer Henry Randall wondered about its accuracy, and put the question to a grandchild, who replied, "I cannot pretend to know what my grandfather said to Mr. Webster, nor can I believe Mr. Webster capable of misstatement. Still, I think the copy of the portrait incorrect, as throwing out all the lights and giving only the shadows. I've heard my grandfather speak with great admiration of General Jackson's military talent. If he called him a dangerous man, unfit for the place to which the nation eventually called him, I think it must have been entirely with reference to his general idea that a military chieftain was no proper head for a peaceful republic, as ours was in those days. He did not like to see the people run away with ideas of military glory." As always, Jefferson was in significant debt. Yet he had, as a favor to a friend, co-signed a note for $20,000 for Virginia Governor Wilson Cary Nicholas in 1819. It was the act of a gentleman and a kinsman. A Nicholas daughter had married a Jefferson grandson. Nicholas was forced to default on the note, leaving the former president responsible for the debt. On the granddaughter-in-law's first call at Monticello since the news of the disaster, Jefferson took care to seek her out. Abashed and horrified by the news, she was unsure how to conduct herself around Jefferson. When he emerged from his rooms, he immediately called for her. "She heard his voice and flew to meet him," Henry Randall wrote. "Instead of the usual hearty handshake and kiss, he folded her in his arms. His smile was radiant. At dinner he spoke with her with great grace. The shame the young woman had felt disappeared. Neither then, nor on any subsequent occasion," wrote Randall, "did he ever by a word or look make her aware that he was even conscious of the misfortune her father had brought upon him." Governor Nicholas himself lived along the route Jefferson traveled to Poplar Forest, and Jefferson knew he could not fail to call on him. "I ought not to stop, I have not time, but it would be cruel to pass him," Jefferson said to a family member as they turned off the road toward Nicholas's place. Meeting his old friend, Jefferson behaved perfectly. He showed no depression, and did not make an equal exposure of his feelings by feigning extraordinary cheerfulness, wrote Randall. For the rest of Nicholas's life, Jefferson treated him as though nothing had happened. A busybody lady once spoke meanly of Nicholas in Jefferson's presence at Monticello, and the former president cut her off politely but firmly. He had, he told her, the highest opinion of Governor Nicholas, and felt the deepest sympathy for his misfortunes. Such was the private character of the man whose public enemies accused him of selfishness, duplicity, inordinate ambition, and cold-bloodedness. The debilitating burden of debt facing Jefferson forced him to do what he liked least in the world, put himself in the hands of others. The market was bad, and so traditional routes of raising capital, finding buyers for his land, were out. Then inspiration struck. He had been, Patsy said, lying awake one night from painful thoughts, when he conceived the notion of holding a lottery. In an appeal to the General Assembly of Virginia, he sought permission to sell tickets in exchange for chances at his lands, mills, and, to his horror, Monticello itself, if his debts were to be retired. However devastating to his pride this would be, he had no other choice. His grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, was in charge of the arrangements. The former president was in a valedictory frame of mind. Asked to send counsel to a young namesake, he composed a significantly longer letter than he tended to write at this point. The subject engaged him, however, and always had. How to live a virtuous life. Adore God, he wrote. Reverence and cherish your parents. Love your neighbor as yourself, and your country more than yourself. Be just. Be true. Murmur not at the ways of providence. So shall the life into which you have entered be the portal to one of eternal and ineffable bliss. There was more, a paraphrased version of Psalm 15. The portrait of a good man by the most sublime of poets for your imitation. Lord, who's the happy man that may to thy blessed courts repair, not stranger like to visit them, but to inhabit there? 'Tis he whose every thought and deed by rules of virtue moves, whose generous tongue disdains to speak the thing his heart disproves, who never did a slander forge his neighbor's fame to wound, nor hearken to a false report by malice whispered round, who vice in all its pomp and power can treat with just neglect, and piety, though clothed in rags, religiously respect. Who to his plighted vows and trust has ever firmly stood, and though he promised to his loss, he makes his promise good. Whose soul in usury disdains his treasure to employ, whom no rewards can ever bribe the guiltless to destroy. The man who by this steady course has happiness insured, when earth's foundations shake, shall stand, by providence secured. And there was yet more. A decalogue of canons for observation in practical life. 1. Never put off till tomorrow what you can do today. 2. Never trouble another for what you can do yourself. 3. Never spend your money before you have it. 4. Never buy what you do not want because it is cheap. It will be dear to you. 5. Pride costs us more than hunger, thirst, and cold. 6. We never repent of having eaten too little. 7. Nothing is troublesome that we do willingly. 8. How much pain have cost us the evils which have never happened. 9. Take things always by their smooth handle. 10. When angry, count 10 before you speak. If very angry, 100. In a bizarre episode in his last years, history almost killed him. A New York artist arrived at Monticello to take a plaster cast of Jefferson's face, a life mask. Something went wrong, however, and the plaster almost suffocated him. Only by banging a chair next to the sofa on which he lay did Jefferson manage to alert his butler, Burl Colbert, to his plight. His life was saved, as his life had been shaped, by the act of a slave. Musing about abolition, and presumably repatriation. In the fading spring, he wrote, "The revolution in public opinion which this cause requires is not to be expected in a day, or perhaps in an age, but time, which outlives all things, will outlive this evil also." His health had been deteriorating since the first day of 1826. "It is now 3 weeks since the reacerbation of my painful complaint, a severe attack of diarrhea, has confined me to the house and indeed my couch," Jefferson wrote a friend in Richmond on January 1, 1826. "Required to be constantly recumbent, I write slowly and with difficulty. Weakened in body by infirmities and in mind by age, now far gone into my 83rd year, reading one newspaper only and forgetting immediately what I read." Still, he refused to give up riding, even though he had to mount his horse, Eagle, by putting the horse on a terrace below and lowering himself into the saddle. With the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence coming in the summer of 1826, organizers of the Washington celebrations were eager to bring Jefferson back to the Capitol for the day. He was too ill to consider it, but in his sun-filled cabinet he drafted a letter to commemorate the occasion. "All eyes are opened or opening to the rights of man," he wrote. "The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. These are grounds of hope for others. For ourselves, let the annual return of this day forever refresh our recollections of these rites and of an undiminished devotion to them." These were to be his last words to the nation he had helped found and which he had led through so much. His farewell to Madison, his friend of half a century, was more personal but as heartfelt. "Take care of me when dead," Jefferson asked in a letter to his old friend in February. Still, he was not expecting an imminent death. After dispatching his letter about liberty to the 4th of July commemoration in Washington, Jefferson wrote another on a different passion, wine, making arrangements to pay the customs collector at Baltimore the tax on an incoming shipment. He would not live to drink it. Soon Jefferson was confined to his bed. He continued to read, browsing through the Bible, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, musing on the great tragedians as time and illness finally caught up with him in the last days of June. The end was at hand. Chapter 43. "No, Doctor, nothing more." The loss of Mr. Jefferson is one over which the whole world will mourn. He was one of those ornaments and benefactors of the human race, whose death forms an epoch and creates a sensation throughout the whole circle of civilized man. Thomas Jefferson's nephew, Dabney Carr, Jr. On Saturday, June 24, 1826, Jefferson painfully put pen to paper to ask Dr. Robley Dunglison to call. Dunglison left Charlottesville as soon as he received the note. When he arrived, he found Jefferson had forced himself from his bedroom into the parlor, as though to greet him in the old ordinary way. Dunglison put him back in bed. The doctor said he was apprehensive that the attack would prove fatal, nor did Mr. Jefferson himself indulge in any other opinion. From this time his strength gradually diminished, and he had to remain in bed. Jefferson now marshaled his will toward the realization of one last mission. He wanted to survive until the 4th of July. As he lay dying, his daughter sat with him during the day. Thomas Jefferson Randolph and Nicholas Trist kept watch in the nights. Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr., the man who had been his son-in-law since moments after the return from Paris more than 30 years before, stayed away. His mind was always clear, it never wandered, his grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, said. He conversed freely and gave directions as to his private affairs. Jefferson told his grandson what he wanted done about his coffin and his burial. There was to be nothing showy or grand. He would take his leave of the world with a simple episcopal service and be laid to rest in the cemetery on the western slope of Monticello, where he had interred Dabney Carr so many decades before, and then his mother, and then his wife. Henry Lee, son of Light Horse Harry Lee, called on Jefferson in the last days of June. Lee was on a mission. He was editing a new edition of his father's Memoirs of the War, a book that treated Jefferson's wartime governorship in an unfavorable light. Even in extremis, Jefferson could not resist one more chance to revise the history of those days. He invited Lee into his sick chamber on Thursday, June 29, 1826. At Monticello, Patsy stopped Lee in the main part of the house. Her father was simply too sick to see him, she said. Saddened, Lee reflected that he was never more to behold the venerable man, who had entered all the walks of politics and philosophy, and in all was foremost, and to whom the past and the present and all future ages are and will be so much indebted. Learning Lee was on hand, Jefferson, lying in his bed, sent for the visitor anyway. "My emotions at approaching Jefferson's dying bed I cannot describe," Lee wrote. "You remember the alcove in which he slept? There he was, extended, feeble, prostrate, but the fine and clear expression of his countenance not all obscured. He recognized Lee and warmly offered his hand from the bed. The energy of his grasp and the spirit of his conversation were such as to make me hope that he would yet rally, and that the superiority of mind over matter in his composition would preserve him yet longer." Jefferson could not help Lee as he had wished. He was too ill to locate the papers he had promised him that gave Jefferson's side of the Arnold Tarleton Cornwallis story. He spoke of death in philosophical, even colloquial terms. He alluded to the probability of his death, as a man would to the prospect of being caught in a shower, as an event not to be desired, but not to be feared. Lee noticed an intriguing detail. Jefferson waved any buzzing flies away from the alcove himself, taking charge of the operation without help from the party gathered around him. He wanted as much control as possible. Mrs. Randolph afterwards told me this was his habit, that his plan was to fight old age off by never admitting the approach of helplessness, Lee wrote. After he left the bedroom for the main part of the house, Lee never laid eyes on Jefferson again. Jefferson's rooms, ordinarily so private, filled as his strength ebbed. He said goodbye to his family, addressing each in turn. Of an 8-year-old grandson, he smiled and said, "George does not understand what all this means." To a great-granddaughter, he quoted the Gospel of Luke, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace." Thomas Jefferson Randolph suggested he was looking better, but Jefferson would have none of it. "Do not imagine for a moment that I feel the smallest solicitude about the result," Jefferson said. "I am like an old watch, with a pinion worn out here and a wheel there, until it can go no longer." He was nearing what he had once referred to as that eternal sleep, which, whether with or without dreams, awaits us hereafter. He awoke to a noise and wondered whether he had heard the name of the Reverend Frederick Hatch, the rector of the parish. "No," he was told. "I have no objection to see him, as a kind and good neighbor," Jefferson said, turning over. He had composed a poem for Patsy, alluding to his imminent reunion with Patty and Polly, and enclosed the lines, "In a little casket she did not open until after he died." "Life's visions are vanished, its dreams are no more. Dear friends of my bosom, why bathed in tears? I go to my father's, I welcome the shore which crowns all my hopes or which buries my cares. Then farewell, my dear, my loved daughter, adieu. The last pang of life is in parting from you. Two seraphs await me long shrouded in death. I will bear them your love on my last parting breath." Lying in his alcove bed, Jefferson mused about the Revolution, telling stories of the great drama. The smallest details reminded him of the largest of struggles. His bed curtains, he noted, had come from the first post-war importations in 1782. In the chambers of his mind, Jefferson may have been hurtling back into the past, hearing again the voices of the House of Burgesses, or of the Pennsylvania State House, or of Versailles, or of the President's House. But part of him remained firmly rooted in the present, somehow keeping track of time, willing himself to live to see, however dimly, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. "A few hours more, Doctor, and it will be all over," he said at one point, only to rally. At 5:45 p.m. on the 2nd, he took laudanum in grog. He was given tea 3 hours later, and brandy 4 hours after that. He slept fitfully as the clock tinged. Then on the evening of the 3rd, at about 7 p.m., he asked Dunglison, "Ah, Doctor, are you still there?" Jefferson's central concern, though, was time. "Is it the 4th?" "It soon will be," Dunglison replied. Jefferson took what would be his last dose of laudanum, muttering, "Oh, God." 2 hours later, at 9 p.m., Dunglison woke him for more medicine. "No, Doctor, nothing more," Jefferson said. The remaining 3 hours passed with agonizing slowness. Jefferson woke late on the night of the 3rd and said in questioning voice, "This is the 4th?" Nicholas Trist remained silent, for it was not. Jefferson spoke again. "This is the 4th?" He would not be stymied. Trist could not bring himself to disappoint the old man and lied by nodding that, yes, it was indeed the 4th. "Ah," said Jefferson, "just as I wished." Perhaps he knew, somehow, that it was not, in fact, the anniversary of his declaration, at least not quite yet, and so Jefferson fought on, breathing still. At last the clock above Jefferson's bed tinged 12 times, ushering in the 4th of July. Drifting in and out of consciousness, Jefferson appeared to dream of ancient crises met and overcome, murmuring about the Revolutionary Committee of Safety, and gesturing as if he were writing. "Warn the committee to be on the alert," he said. He was dwelling on danger. In his last hours he was still struggling to defend the American cause, if only in his flickering imagination. At 4 o'clock in the morning, he gave the attending slaves some directions. The final words of a man whose first memory was of being handed up to a slave on a pillow were addressed to his slaves. For a man who had worked for and witnessed so much change, in the end, some things were as they were in the beginning. At 10, he stirred and stared at a grandson, trying but failing to signal what he wanted. It was Burl Colbert who interpreted the glance correctly. Jefferson wanted his head elevated. The butler arranged him as he wished. An hour later he was moving his parched lips but saying nothing. Much to his evident relief, a grandson lifted a wet sponge to Jefferson's mouth. It was over. At 10 minutes before 1 o'clock on Tuesday, July 4th, 1826, Thomas Jefferson died in his bed, 3 miles from Shadwell, where he had been born a subject of the British Empire, 8 decades before. He died with his eyes open, his gaze fixed on his beloved alcove, his shelter from the storms of a world in which he had long warred, often triumphed, and always loved. Thomas Jefferson Randolph touched his grandfather's cooling skin, gently closing the great man's eyes. Nicholas Trist quietly clipped a few small locks of his still sandy hair, relics for the family. The wooden coffin, built by John Hemmings, was made ready. The body was transferred to it, and the coffin was taken to the parlor to rest in state. To me he has been more than a father, and I have ever loved and reverenced him with my whole heart, Dabney Carr, Jr., wrote Nicholas Trist a week later. A grieving James Madison wrote Trist, "He lives and will live in the memory and gratitude of the wise and the good, as a luminary of science, as a votary of liberty, as a model of patriotism and as a benefactor of humankind. The professor of ancient languages at the University of Virginia said, "He ought to be revered by all who enjoy the advantage of being educated in his university and ever remembered as one of the great men whom Virginia has produced. His great deeds are recorded in the epitaph which he wrote for his own tomb." Wormley Hughes, the gardener, dug Jefferson's grave on the western side of the mountain. The weather had been wet when the funeral party gathered inside Monticello for Jefferson's final journey. The mourners were few. Jefferson had not wanted a large service, and a delegation from the university in Charlottesville got a late start, missing much of the final rites. A small group of family, friends, and slaves escorted the wooden coffin down the hill from the house. The Reverend Hatch read the burial office over the grave. The service was conducted from the Episcopal Book of Common Prayer. "I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord," Hatch read. "He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live, and whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die." The promise of Paris was honored. In his life and in his will, Jefferson had kept his word to Sally Hemings. Of the four children of Jefferson and Sally who survived to adulthood, Beverly and Harriet had been allowed to leave Monticello in the early 1820s, and both are said to have lived as whites. According to their son, Madison Hemings, Harriet married a white man in good standing in Washington City. She raised a family of children, and so far as I know, they were never suspected of being tainted with African blood in the community where she lived or lives. Madison was freed in Jefferson's will and ultimately moved to Ohio, as did Eston, who eventually settled in Wisconsin and changed his name to Eston Jefferson and declared himself to be white. In his will, Jefferson also freed three other members of the Hemings family, Burl Colbert, John Hemings, and Joe Fawcett. Jefferson freed no other slaves, only Hemingses. Sally Hemings herself, now 53 years old, soon moved to Charlottesville and lived without incident as a free woman. Jefferson did not name her in his will, yet there is evidence that his wishes may have been implicitly clear to Patsy and his heirs. Sally Hemings was to be treated with respect. In 1834, Patsy gave Sally Hemings her time, an unofficial emancipation, and Sally had been free, in fact, since Jefferson's death. In time, Sally died in 1835, she bequeathed some mementos of Jefferson to her children, a pair of his glasses, an inkwell, and a shoe buckle. Jefferson's tenuous hold on life had been the only thing keeping his heavily indebted plantations from his creditors. The lottery he had hoped would rescue his affairs died with him. When Jefferson died, he owed creditors, in early 21st century terms, between $1 million and $2 million. So much that Monticello and his slaves had to be sold. Jefferson's ideas and his public work endured. His personal world did not. 600 miles away, John Adams, 90 years old, had died on the same day as Jefferson, also at home in bed. A coincidence the incumbent president John Quincy Adams called visible and palpable marks of divine favor, for which I would humble myself in grateful and silent adoration before the ruler of the universe. Preparing a eulogy to deliver at Faneuil Hall in Boston, Daniel Webster wrote his remarks one morning before breakfast, later recalling that when he was done, my paper was wet with my tears. On a beautiful day in Boston, with President Adams in the hall, Webster painted an indelible portrait of Jefferson's and Adams' ascent to the American Pantheon. On our 50th anniversary, the great day of national jubilee, in the very hour of public rejoicing, in the midst of echoing and re-echoing voices of thanksgiving, while their own names were on all tongues, they took their flight together to the world of spirits. On his own deathbed, some of John Adams' final words were said to be about his old rival and friend, "Thomas Jefferson survives, and so he does." Epilogue. All honor to Jefferson. Jefferson's principles are sources of light, because they are not made up of pure reason, but spring out of aspiration, impulse, vision, sympathy. They burn with the fervor of the heart. Woodrow Wilson, 1912. He survives as he lived, in many ways and in many different lights. In the immediate aftermath of his death, he was, together with Adams, recognized chiefly for the Revolution of 1776, the virtues of which were beyond dispute in the American mind. To have been the instrument of expressing in one brief, decisive act the concentrated will and resolution of a whole family of states, said Congressman Edward Everett of Massachusetts in an 1826 eulogy, of unfolding in one all-important manifesto the causes, the motives, and the justification of the great movement in human affairs. This is the glory of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson's finished work was the creation of an imperfect but lasting democratic habit of mind and heart. Mr. Jefferson meant that the American system should be a democracy, and he would rather have let the whole world perish than that this principle, which to him represented all that man was worth, should fail, wrote the historian Henry Adams. Mr. Hamilton considered democracy a fatal curse and meant to stop its progress. Ellen Wales Coolidge was en route from Boston to Charlottesville when the news of her grandfather's death reached her in New York. She arrived at Monticello long after the funeral was over. To her, the place that had been home was now a foreign land. "He was gone," she wrote Henry Randall many years later, recalling the pain of her return. "His place was empty. I visited his grave, but the whole house at Monticello, with its large apartments and lofty ceilings, appeared to me one vast monument." Such was the power of Jefferson, though, that Ellen expected him to appear to her at any moment, to hear his voice, to look into his eyes, to feel his touch once more. "I wandered about the vacant rooms as if I were looking for him," she said. "Had I not seen him there all the best years of my life? I passed hours in his chamber. It was just as he had left it. There was the bed on which he had slept for so many years, the chair in which, when I entered the room, I always found him sitting, articles of dress still in their places, his clock by which he had told so many useful hours. In the cabinet adjoining were his books, the beloved companions of his leisure, his writing table from which I gathered some small relics, memoranda and scraps of written paper which I still preserve. All seemed as if he had just quitted the rooms, and there were moments when I felt as if I expected his return." She was in a curiously dreamlike state. "For days I started at what seemed the sound of his step or his voice, and caught myself listening for both. In the dining room where, in winter, we passed a good deal of time, there was the low armchair, which he always occupied by the fireside, with his little round table still standing as when it held his book or his candle. In the tea-room was the sofa where, in summer, I had so often sat by his side. In the large parlor, with its parquet floor, stood the Campeachy chair, where, in the shady twilight, I was used to see him resting. In the great hall, with its large glass doors, where, in bad weather, he liked to walk, how much I liked to walk with him. Everything told of him. An invisible presence seemed everywhere to preside." Finally, she left the house and the estate, never to return. Her grandfather lived for her in her heart and mind. And in her nation's. Like his grieving granddaughter in the summer of 1826, Americans have never quite let Jefferson go. "If Jefferson was wrong," wrote the biographer James Parton in 1874, "America is wrong. If America is right, Jefferson was right." That is a remarkable burden to put on any one man or any one vision of politics, but the observation resonates because in death Jefferson remains much as he was in life, a vivid, engaging, breathing figure, brilliant and eloquent, at once monumental and human. It is difficult to imagine having a glass of wine with George Washington at Mount Vernon and talking of many things. It seems the most natural thing in the world to imagine doing so with Thomas Jefferson at Monticello, surrounded by paintings from France and busts from Philadelphia, and artifacts from the dazzling world of the expedition of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. Jefferson speaks to us now because he spoke so powerfully and evocatively to us then. His circumstances were particular, yet the general issues that consumed him are constant: liberty and power, rights and responsibilities, the keeping of peace, and the waging of war. He was a politician, a public man, in a nation in which politics and public life became and remain central. As Jefferson wrote, "Man feels that he is a participator in the government of affairs not merely at an election, one day in the year, but every day. Had he been only a philosopher, he would not have endured as he does. Had he been only a legislator or a diplomat, or only an inventor, or only an author, or only an educator, or even only a president, he would not have endured as he does. He endures because we can see in him all the varied and wondrous possibilities of the human experience, the thirst for knowledge, the capacity to create, the love of family and of friends, the hunger for accomplishment, the applause of the world, the marshalling of power, the bending of others to one's own vision. His genius lay in his versatility, his larger political legacy in his leadership of thought and of men. With his brilliance and his accomplishment and his fame, he is immortal. Yet because of his flaws and his failures, he strikes us as mortal too, a man of achievement, who was nonetheless susceptible to the temptations and compromises that ensnare all of us. He was not all he could be, but no politician, no human being, ever is. We sense his greatness because we know that perfection in politics is not possible, but that Jefferson passed the fundamental test of leadership. Despite all his shortcomings and all the inevitable disappointments and mistakes and dreams deferred, he left America and the world in a better place than it had been when he first entered the arena of public life. Jefferson is the founding president who charms us most. George Washington inspires awe, John Adams, respect. With his grace and hospitality, his sense of taste and love of beautiful things, of silver and art and architecture and gardening and food and wine, Jefferson is more alive, more convivial. 19th-century secessionists and 20th-century states' rights purists have found him a hero. Progressive leaders from Woodrow Wilson to FDR to Truman have believed him to embody the best impulses in the American tradition of popular government. So who was he, really? In the most literal sense, the only real Jefferson is the man who lived and loved and led and was carried to his grave in a wooden coffin on a wet summer's day in 1826. The real Jefferson was like so many of us, a bundle of contradictions, competing passions, flaws, sins, and virtues that can never be neatly smoothed out into a tidy whole. The closest thing to a constant in his life was his need for power and for control. He tended to mask these drives so effectively, however, that even the most astute of observers of his life and work have had trouble detecting them. "The leadership he sought was one of sympathy and love, not of command," wrote Henry Adams, but that was not quite the case. For him, sympathy and love among the members of his political circle were means to an end, and the end was command. If he had found that affection was insufficient to accumulate the power he wanted, he would have found other ways to govern. All the other Jeffersons, the emblematic ones, the metaphorical ones, the ones different generations and differing partisans interpret and invent, seeking inspiration from his example and sanction from his name, all these Jeffersons tell us more about ourselves than they do about the man himself. He can be claimed by many, and always will be. The greatest of men often are. They are spoken of and thought about because their ideas resonate and their battles recur. His most significant successors have defined him in terms of his vision of liberty and union. To do so, of course, requires choosing between the author of the Declaration of Independence and the author of the Kentucky Resolutions, of deciding to trumpet the voice of the man who believed secession fatal to America, instead of the man who wrote about the primacy of states' rights. The finest presidents working in Jefferson's wake have made those choices and taken those decisions, creating a Jefferson that represents the best of the American spirit and the possibilities of politics in an imperfect world. In the early days of April 1859, from Springfield, Illinois, Abraham Lincoln wrote to a group in Boston, declining its invitation to speak to a Jefferson birthday celebration. The moment gave Lincoln the chance, though, to link Jefferson to the cause of freedom in an hour of danger for the Union. The principles of Jefferson are the definitions and axioms of free society, Lincoln wrote, and yet they are denied and evaded with no small show of success. Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves, and under a just God cannot long retain it. The slave owner was thus being drafted to serve as an emblem of liberty, not only for white men, but for blacks. Such, in Lincoln's view, was the core of the Jefferson vision, and he hailed the author of the Declaration of Independence for turning the ideal into the real amid the war and chaos of the Revolution. "All honor to Jefferson," said Lincoln, "to the man who, in the concrete pressure of a struggle for national independence by a single people, had the coolness, forecast, and capacity to introduce into a merely revolutionary document an abstract truth applicable to all men and all times, and so to embalm it there that today and in all coming days it shall be a rebuke and a stumbling block to the very harbingers of reappearing tyranny and oppression." 70 years later, in St. Paul, Minnesota, in 1932, Franklin D. Roosevelt did what Lincoln had done in 1859. He sought the mantle of Jefferson. It is not necessary for us in any way to discredit the great financial genius of Alexander Hamilton or the school of thought of the early Federalists, to point out that they were frank in their belief that certain sections of the nation and certain individuals within those sections were more fitted than others to conduct government, Roosevelt told the Jefferson Day dinner in St. Paul. It was the purpose of Jefferson to teach the country that the solidarity of federalism was only a partial one, that it represented only a minority of the people, that to build a great nation, the interests of all groups in every part must be considered, and that only in a large national unity could real security be found. A master of politics himself, FDR appreciated a kindred spirit. Jefferson, he said, has been called a politician because he devoted years to the building of a political party. But this labor was in itself a definite and practical act aimed at the unification of all parts of the country in support of common principles. When people carelessly or snobbishly deride political parties, they overlook the fact that the party system of government is one of the greatest methods of unification and of teaching people to think in common terms of our civilization. Jefferson's words were elemental parts of the language of America. In September 1948, at the Bonham High School football stadium in Bonham, Texas, hometown of House Speaker Sam Rayburn, Harry S. Truman invoked Jefferson. "I have a profound faith in the people of this country. I believe in their common sense. They love freedom, and that love for freedom and justice is not dead. Our people believe today, as Jefferson did, that men were not born with saddles on their backs to be ridden by the privileged few. We believe, as Jefferson did, that the God who gave us life gave us liberty. We protect our liberty against those who threaten it from abroad, and we do not propose to give it up to those who threaten it at home. We will not give up our democratic way to a dictatorship of the left, neither will we give it up to a despotism of special privilege." In the waning days of his own presidency, in December 1988, Ronald Reagan traveled to the lawn of Mr. Jefferson's University of Virginia to speak to students. For Reagan, Jefferson's pure republicanism and quotations about a limited national government had long been sacred texts. Saluting Jefferson's transforming genius, Reagan said, "The pursuit of science, the study of the great works, the value of free inquiry, In short, the very idea of living the life of the mind. Yes, these formative and abiding principles of higher education in America had their first and firmest advocate and their greatest embodiment in a tall, fair-headed, friendly man who watched this university take form from the mountainside where he lived. The university, whose founding he called a crowning achievement to a long and well-spent life. The men, and now the women, of the university were not alone in feeling the great man's living spirit. "Presidents know about this, too," Reagan said. Jefferson was a permanent guardian over his successors, for directly down the lawn and across the ellipse from the White House are those ordered classic lines of the Jefferson Memorial, and the eyes of the 19-foot statue that gazed directly into the White House, a reminder to any of us who might occupy that mansion of the quality of mind and generosity of heart that once abided there and has been so rarely seen there again. Reagan, himself a visionary with a pragmatic streak, a deft communicator of political ideals, a transformative leader, intuitively understood the third president. "He knew how disorderly a place the world could be," Reagan said. Indeed, as a leader of rebellion, he was himself an architect, if you will, of disorder. But he also believed that man had received from God a precious gift of enlightenment, the gift of reason, a gift that could extract from the chaos of life meaning, truth, order. Jefferson would have been hard put to describe the matter more clearly. From Roosevelt to Reagan, Jefferson provided inspiration for radically different understandings of government and culture. Yet it was not Jefferson who had changed. It was his nation, tacking this way and then that way. That Jefferson has been a lodestar from generation to generation, from agenda to agenda, from vision to vision, speaks as much to his own literary versatility as to anything the real Jefferson did when he stood at the helm, directing America through the storms of his own time. One thing is unmistakably consistent, however, in his successors' understanding of Jefferson. Like him, they believed in the power of words in public life, in the molding of popular opinion, and in the centrality of presidential power to keep the nation safe and strong in the most difficult of hours. The three achievements he ordered carved on his tombstone, as author of the American Declaration of Independence, and of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, and as founder of the University of Virginia, speak to his love of the liberty of the mind and of the heart, and to his faith in the future. They point to the least disputable elements of his long, turbulent life, to the primacy of reason and the possibilities of freedom, and the eternal quest for wisdom. They point, too, to the making of things, to leadership. He fought for each of these causes, convincing enough of the world of the rightness of his vision that he left behind living monuments. And there is no greater monument to Jefferson than the nation itself, dedicated to the realization, however gradual and however painful, of the ideal amid the realities of a political world driven by ambition and selfishness. For Jefferson never gave up on America, a country in many ways he brought into being, and which he nurtured through tender, fragile hours. And I have observed this march of civilization advancing from the seacoast, passing over us like a cloud of light, increasing our knowledge and improving our condition. And where this progress will stop, no one can say, he wrote in 1824. Jefferson arranged the world as he wanted it until the very end, and beyond. When he died in the midsummer of 1826, he was borne across the sprawling west lawn, past willow trees and down the hill to the graveyard. The cemetery was, of course, of his own design. Here he had buried his mother, his wife, his children, his best friend. Here he was to be buried. The little graveyard sits on the western side of the mountain. When dusk comes, darkness seems to fall slowly. To the east, shadows lengthen over the Rivanna and over Shadwell. They fall over Monticello itself and over Mulberry Row. They fall over his pavilions and his gardens. Only then do the shadows fall over the remains of Thomas Jefferson, a man who always loved the light.
This is John Meacham. In late 1803, a French diplomat in Washington, Louis-André Pichon, drafted a special letter about President Jefferson to send back to the Foreign Ministry in Paris. "It is difficult, citizen minister," Pichon began, "to give a definitive judgment on the character of Mr. Jefferson, as well as on the effect that could be produced internally by his policy and his systems." It is indeed. It is not, however, impossible. This book, I hope, neither lionizes nor indicts Jefferson, but instead restores him to his full and rich role as an American statesman who resists easy labeling. Jefferson has not had an easy time of it in recent years. The 1998 DNA findings and subsequent scholarly reevaluation that established the high likelihood of his sexual relationship with his slave Sally Hemings, a liaison long denied by mainstream white historians, gave fresh energy to the image of Jefferson as hypocrite. Then came nearly two decades of highly acclaimed biographies of John Adams, of Alexander Hamilton, and of George Washington, that understandably emphasized the virtues of their protagonists, often at Jefferson's expense. My friend Joseph J. Ellis started this trend with Passionate Sage, The Character and Legacy of John Adams, published 20 years ago. Even in his own day, Jefferson faced the seemingly contradictory charges that he was at once an unrealistic philosopher and a scheming political creature. The truth in Jefferson's case, as in so many lives, is complex. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Theodore and Franklin Roosevelt were great men and impressive presidents, but only Thomas Jefferson ranged across so many different aspects of American life over such a long period of time. Cool and cerebral, Jefferson could not resist the heat of political combat, and he adapted his brilliantly expressed principles to the realities of elections and of governing with seeming effortlessness. Many Americans idolized him. Others shared the views of an anonymous letter writer who told him, "You are the damnedest fool that God put life into. God damn you." My view is that at his core, from year to year and age to age, Thomas Jefferson was a politician who sought office and, once in office, tried to solve problems and set a course for the future within the constraints of his time and his place. That he often did so with skill is a tribute to his life and is, I think, the heart of his legacy. For without a compelling political figure making the case for the principles and practices in which he believed, American life and politics could have turned out very differently. Jefferson the politician, then, was a man who stood on the ramparts of history, fighting for a particular habit of mind and of government that gave the many more of a role to play in the fullness of time than the few. I did not set out to write a full life and times of Jefferson. Too much happened to him and around him for a single volume to do justice to the immensity of scholarship about the late 18th and early 19th centuries. This book is a portrait, rather, of the man and of the world in which he lived and which he longed to bend to his purposes. The Jefferson I found in my reading and research was a public man of Renaissance interest, but with an abiding, overarching concern, the fate of democratic republicanism in America. The most remarkable stories are those of politicians who do the best they can given time and chance, and whose faults are at once personal and universal. The most accomplished presidents manage, however briefly, to transcend those constraints and overcome those faults in order to leave the nation a better, more just place than they found it. The test cannot be perfection or an American Valhalla, for no one can meet such a standard. Thomas Jefferson surely did not. He did his best, though, and his best left the world a definition, if not a realization, of human liberty that has endured and gave America the means to ascend to global power. I do not believe that we can make sense of Jefferson without a grasp of how seriously he took the possibility of the imminent end of the American experiment and the return of a monarchical government. Beginning with George Washington himself, contemporaries and later historians have treated Jefferson's fears of monarchy as fanciful, paranoid, or at best exaggerated to the point of unseriousness. Based on my reading of Jefferson's papers and archival explorations in the United States and in Britain, however, I contend that the threat of a revival of British authority in the United States was as fundamental to Jefferson's thought and actions as the Cold War with the Soviet Union was to American presidents from Truman to George H.W. Bush. The analogy is imprecise, to be sure, for Britain and the United States alternated between friendship and hostility. Another imprecise analogy, but one worth considering, is that Jefferson was to Washington and Adams what Dwight Eisenhower was to Franklin D. Roosevelt and to Harry Truman, a president who reformed, but essentially ratified, an existing course of government. It is also impossible to understand the historical human Jefferson without appreciating the perennial place the events and legacy of the English Civil War played in his imagination and in the imaginations of many of his contemporaries. The important role of the Whig tradition of individual liberty has long been noted. Less remarked upon is the frequency with which the battles and incidents of the struggle appear in Jefferson's correspondence, a sign that the war and the fate of the Commonwealth, which was a military dictatorship followed by restoration of monarchy, were never far from Jefferson's consciousness. As a rule, politicians tend to remember the things they wish to emulate or the things they hope to avoid. For America, Jefferson wanted neither a Cromwellian absolutism, nor the restoration of Charles II in 1660, nor even the installation of William and Mary in 1688, two monarchs who had fewer prerogatives, but who were still monarchs. Such outcomes, Jefferson believed, were all too plausible.
This is Edward Herman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, by John Meacham. This program was directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2012 by John Meacham. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.